Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
The Psychology of Evil.
Look into my face. And no, to look into my face is to look into the face of evil.
What is the mind of an evil person really like?
Are the truly evil just like the rest of us with one additional screw loose?
Are some people just naturally evil?
You're quasi-evil. You're semi-evil. You're the margarine of evil.
Our guest is Simon Baron Cohen, author of The Science of Evil, on empathy and the origins of cruelty.
You're the Diet Coke of evil. Just one calorie, not evil enough.
The Psychology of Evil.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that we began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the psychology of evil.
Ken, humans are capable of unspeakable cruelty.
From the large-scale horrors of the Holocaust, or the Rwandan genocide, or Cambodia's killing fields,
to smaller acts of murder and mayhem that infest every city in the world every day.
There are no limits, John, on what some people will do to other people.
The pervasiveness of evil and cruelty has puzzled philosophers and theologians, too, for centuries.
Religious thinkers, for example, have wondered, how can a world created by a just, loving, all-powerful, and all-knowing God be so suffused with evil?
We philosophers ask, is an evil person a person who's irrational to some extreme degree? Or are they completely rational but kind of lack feeling?
Today, we're going to look at evil from a different perspective, that of psychology and neuroscience.
Before one can locate evil in the neural circuitry of the brain, one has to know what one is looking for. And philosophy can be helpful there. I mean, we have to say, what counts as evil?
So what we're after is the set of character traits that might lead someone to commit the kinds of acts we call evil. That's why we call a person evil, because of their character.
But the first step might be to say, why do we call an act evil? Here's a thought. It shows wanton disregard for the well-being of another person, or worse.
So why not just say then that an evil person is someone who habitually performs evil acts?
Uninformative and unscientific, Ken. It's like saying that a sleeping pill makes a person fall asleep because it's got dormitive power. We don't want to know that. We want to know what it's made of that has that effect.
Well, unfortunately, the word evil used as a term for a character trait is sort of like dormitive power. It isn't really a scientific term at all.
That's because it wasn't coined by people who were out to understand the circuitry of the brain.
So when you call a person evil, that tells you nothing whatsoever about what their brain is like. Nothing whatsoever.
For most of it, it's an evaluative term. If you say someone's evil, that's not a nice thing to say about them.
Right. The linguistic function, as philosophers like to say, of the term evil is mostly to condemn. It's not really in the business of explaining or describing.
Science, however, is in the business of explaining and describing. So if we want to understand the psychology and the neuroscience, the brain chemistry of evil, we need to put the evaluative aside, at least for a while, and talk in more causal and descriptive terms.
So to that end, we've invited a psychologist to be our guest. Simon Baron Cohen has developed a scientific account of what's going on in the minds and brains of people who habitually perform evil acts.
He thinks cruelty and evil result from diminished empathy, and he thinks he can track empathy down to 10 hardwired empathy circuits in the brain, and when one or more of them goes haywire, you've got diminished empathy.
But before we plunge into psychology and neuroscience, John, let's just back up a step to philosophy and theology. Because I wonder something. Will thinking about evil and cruelty in terms of hardwired empathy circuits, will that replace or will it supplement our philosophical and theological perspectives on evil?
Well, I don't see how I can replace them because we philosophers and theologians, too, I guess we have our own business to attend to, like the whole issue of free will.
But can the idea that a person isn't really evil unless he freely chooses to do evil things, that's a philosophical idea, can that idea withstand the discovery that cruelty is caused by malfunctioning brain chemistry?
And is it really true that people with ordinary brain chemistry are incapable of evil? Even if we try really hard and devote ourselves to becoming evil, couldn't we succeed? Doesn't the capacity for evil lurk in the hearts or the brains of all of us?
In just a bit, we'll put these questions and more to Simon Baron Cohen, author of The Science of Evil, on empathy and the origins of cruelty.
And we want to hear from our very empathetic listening audience as well.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, puts her own friends to the test to find out how empathetic they really are. She files this report.
I think I'm a really, really empathetic person.
Like on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being not empathetic and 10 being overly empathetic, I'm probably like 7.
I think everyone wants to believe they're an empathetic person.
Most people in America, especially in California, think that empathy means niceness, that it's synonymous with being nice to people, which is not the case.
Thomas Lewis is a psychiatrist and an expert on empathy.
Empathy is a skill, like music is a skill or like drawing is a skill. It's a particular skill for knowing what other people think and feel.
And empathy can be measured. The questionnaire I'm administering was actually developed by our guest, Simon Baron Cohen, and the results are pretty surprising.
Number one, I can easily tell if someone else wants to enter a conversation. Definitely agree.
Question 11. It doesn't bother me too much if I am late meeting a friend. I slightly agree. People don't mind that much if you're late in Brazil. It's nothing to do with me not being empathetic.
I can tune in to how someone else feels rapidly and intuitively. I think I can. I'm going to say I agree with that.
26. I'm quick to spot when someone in a group is feeling awkward or uncomfortable. Strongly agree. It takes one to know one.
38. It upsets me to see an animal in pain. Yes, obviously I strongly agree. It upsets me to see an animal in pain. Except maybe chickens.
Out of 80 possible points, a score of 32 to 52 is considered normal. Most men get about 42, most women get about 47.
I scored a 51, which is average. I found that surprising because I was expecting to score very high or definitely above average.
Very often people are poor judges of their own personality traits and characteristics, so that if you really want to know what people are like, it's often better to ask their friends.
I would say Emma is somewhere in the higher range, like if she was in like the 70s out of 80, I wouldn't be surprised.
So I got a 65. I think that in some ways, like, that level of empathy is definitely crippling and paralyzing at times.
Your score, 35. So I'm less than half, so I guess that makes me somewhat unempathetic.
Tom, I've always known him to be relatively unemotional, so the whole him not being empathetic is sort of like my worst fear come true.
There's an advantage in life to pairing up with someone who's not like you because they can help you through the situations that you're not so good at. So if you're an unempathic man, but you're with an empathic woman, she can help you and guide you through social situations where you might blunder and not know what to do.
This test kind of seems like some snake oil to me. The way you tell someone is empathetic is by knowing them. And I think that anyone who knows me would give me an 80 on this test.
But don't feel too badly for these folks. Dr. Lewis says if you scored low on the questionnaire, with a little bit of practice, it's possible to improve our empathy skills.
My score was a 32. 0 to 32 is low. I'm fine. Don't worry about me, everybody. I'm fine.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Simon Baron Cohen. He's a professor of developmental psychology at Cambridge University. He's author of The Science of Evil, on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. Simon, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, nice to be on the show.
Simon, evil is obviously a morally and politically gripping topic, but scientifically, how did evil first pique your scientific curiosity?
Well, the problem to be explained for me isn't evil, it's the actions, and in particular actions of cruelty. So as a scientist, we want to know how is it possible that human beings are capable of acts of cruelty towards other people or other animals. And we often use this word evil as if it's an explanation. We say he did something bad because he was evil. But as a scientist, that seems very unsatisfying. It doesn't really take us any deeper or further. And if you analyze the word evil, the one definition of evil is it's the absence of good. So actually all we're saying is he did something bad because he's bad. You know, it's a bit circular.
Well, but I mean, if you talk about diminished empathy, you can say, well, that means the diminishment of empathy, right? I mean, how do you get from these kinds of terms, evil, diminishment of empathy, that don't really tell us anything by themselves, to something that really tells us something? Where does the science get in?
Well, science is all about measurement, and it's all about making predictions. So anything that can satisfy those two essential functions, I think, is scientifically useful or tractable. So in the case of empathy, we do have ways of measuring it. We just heard from your reporter, Caitlin, about the empathy quotient. It's a questionnaire. And that shows us that empathy is normally distributed in the population. That's to say, you see the familiar bell curve with most people in the middle, somewhere in the average range. But it is picking out that there are people up at the high end or the low end. So if it's measurable, then it's useful to science.
Wait, okay, I get that empathy varies from individual to individual, that you can measure it, that you might be able to discover some brain circuitry that controls empathy. But I'm a little puzzled by the title of your book. The title of your book is The Science of Evil. Then you told us that, well, evil's not really a scientific term, which is something I kind of agree with. So what I'm just a little puzzled what you mean by this title when you say the science of evil, right? Well, why? How can there be a science of something that's not a scientific notion?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So anyone who's hoping that they're going to read in this book about the science of evil itself is going to be disappointed, because really this is a book about the science of a term that I think should replace evil, which is empathy erosion. Mm-hmm. And as I've mentioned earlier, I think empathy is scientifically tractable. We can do something with it. And the erosion of empathy, meaning that you go lower and lower down the scale till you hit zero, is something that we can ask questions about. We can ask, what is it that determines if an individual ends up with low empathy? And in the book, I look at not just the brain circuitry, as you've mentioned, but a range of factors that can push an individual to have low empathy.
But now, I have a basic question about this replacing evil with diminishment of empathy. Empathy is usually defined as the ability to understand what's going on inside other people, their feelings, and so forth and so on. But some of the cruelest people I've known have a lot of empathy. They're very good at understanding what goes on inside other people, and then they manipulate it. And that's quite, you know, they're pretty evil, but I don't think they have diminished empathy.
Right. No, I'm really glad you pointed that out, because in my book, I separate empathy into two different components. So the first component is the recognition element, what psychologists call cognitive empathy. So that's all about being able to recognize what someone else is thinking or feeling. And you're absolutely right. Psychopaths can do that part, even though they go on to commit acts of cruelty. But the second component is what psychologists call affective empathy. It's the drive to respond emotionally to somebody else's state of mind, respond with an appropriate emotion to someone else's state of mind. So it's not just about, can you recognize that your victim is in pain, but do you get the appropriate emotional response, which would be to alleviate a person's distress?
Isn't that what we usually call sympathy?
Well, I think sympathy is a subset of empathy. Because it's about responding to somebody else's state of distress. But empathy covers not just somebody else's distress. It could cover any mental state that they're in. It could be their happiness. It could be their bewilderment. It could be any state of mind. And when you're empathic, when you're empathizing with them, you have an emotional response that's appropriate to their state of mind.
We'll dig into this some more. There's some complicated stuff going on here, and I think we need to really dig in. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about the psychology of evil with Simon Baron-Cohen from Cambridge University.
Next, we're going to ask where evil comes from. Are we all capable of evil or diminished empathy? Or is evil what happens to the neurochemically abnormal? Are evil people born that way? Or does their environment and upbringing condition them to become evil?
Where does evil come from? When Philosophy Talk continues.
We all do bad things. But when does a bad thing become an evil thing? We're talking about the psychology of evil. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. Are people who are neurologically normal, like you and me, presumably, capable of great evil? Or does genuine cruelty require abnormal brain circuitry, a complete absence of empathy? Are people born evil, or are they made evil by their environment and upbringing? Have you ever experienced directly an evil person acting evil toward you?
Our guest is Simon Baron Cohen, author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty.
So, Simon, you've made it clear that you're really trying to replace the notion of evil with a more scientific, more measurable thing. But I'm still a little confused. I mean, your book is mostly about empathy and individual variations in empathy and how that can lead us to do bad things. But it's intuitively, I'm not really all that clear about the connection between evil, as we ordinarily understand it, and empathy and lack thereof. I mean, it's not obvious to me that every person who lacks empathy is evil. I mean, that every person with empathy is good, right? So tell me more about the connection between evil and empathy and all that.
So I take it as definitional that when somebody commits a cruel act, their empathy has been switched off or has gone down, whether temporarily or in some individuals, it's a more enduring or permanent set of difficulties. But I see as a part of how to explain acts of cruelty is that empathy is not functioning at least the average level.
When you say that, let me slow you down. When you say that, can I be empathetic toward one person and not empathetic toward another? So I can imagine a slaveholder, say, not very empathetic toward his slaves, but very empathetic toward his family, his friends, his slave-owning brethren, willing to go to war to defend their right, right?
That's absolutely right. So empathy is always between two individuals. And, so you are one of them, and the other person that you're directing your empathy towards is the other. And there are different factors that could influence how much empathy you show towards one person or another. As you say, it could be because you're a slave owner and you've decided that slaves don't deserve any empathy. It could be because you live in a racist culture where your culture has told you that particular subgroups in the population deserve no empathy.
Another kind of situation is where someone has done something unspeakable to someone that you're very empathetic with, and you have it in your power to hurt, torture, kill, make life miserable for that person. So in a way, the empathy drives the lack of empathy.
You see what he's getting at? Suppose I had Hitler in my hands right now, or the perpetrators of genocide somewhere else, or some mass murderer. I'd say, you killed my brethren, and I don't care that this hurt. I want this to hurt you. I want to. So I'm empathetically motivated by my concern for his victims to do something unempathetic toward him.
Absolutely. But, your empathy is for the victims, but your empathy is not for the perpetrator. And so you're able to switch off your empathy for the perpetrator. And that could be, completely understandable for reasons of revenge, for example, where that the emotion of revenge may interfere with your capacity to empathize, or it may even block your capacity to empathize. But either way, if you have Hitler sitting in front of you and you have this overwhelming desire to kill him, clearly you have no empathy for Hitler himself. Now, I'm not suggesting, just to make it clear for all your listeners, that I have any sympathy with any of Hitler's views, but we're just trying to get it very clear that at the moment of an act where you can hurt another person, the claim is your empathy is switched off for that person.
So in your book, you talk a bit about sort of transient empathy that's switched on and off, But you talk a lot more about the zero, people with zero empathy. And you talk about zero negative and zero positive. That seems like a kind of permanent, there are people whose empathy circuits are sort of permanently or at least long-term damaged in some way. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, empathy is like many other psychological processes. So day to day, moment by moment, you are going to see fluctuations. And that would be true if we were looking at any other psychological process like memory or like language. Sometimes we're more fluent or more able to memorize than other times. So I'm less interested in the moment-by-moment fluctuations. I'm much more interested in this book to look at people who, over a whole lifetime, have had an enduring lack of empathy and to understand how they got there. And I look at what I call zero negative types, so people who have 0 degrees of empathy and where that is negative for them and negative for everybody around them. And that mostly corresponds to what psychiatry calls the personality disorders.
Now, Simon, let me just fill in the listeners a little on the scientific perspective of your book. You can correct me. But we've really got two kind of different parts of science going on. Here we've got psychology, the development of this tests or battery of tests that were mentioned in the Roving Philosophical Report that must be getting at something real because it gives us this nice bell curve. And so independently of looking into a person's brain or looking at their activity, you have a way of saying, well, this person has very little empathy and this person has a lot of empathy. Then you've done brain imaging of various kinds to say, well, what is it about people that have empathy when they have empathy and what's lacking with people that don't? And you've got some results there. You've got these, 10 different parts of the brain that are involved in the empathy circuit.
Yeah.
So this is real science here. Happens in the brain in one of these cases, like Ken was mentioning, where you've got a lot of empathy, your brain is seething with empathy for one person, but you're empathetic with another. Have you traced that down to the brain chemistry level?
Well, the difficulty is doing any brain scanning on an individual whilst they're experiencing low empathy for a particular person.
Mm-hmm.
But at the most, what we've been able to do, or what the field of neuroscience has been able to do, is look at groups of people who have low empathy, like psychopaths, and look to see what's happening in that empathy circuit in the brain. And sure enough, what you find is there's underactivity in many of those regions in the empathy circuit. I could list some of those regions for you, but there's 10 different regions in the brain. So that's giving us some confirmation that people who, at the level of behavior, show low empathy, they're willing to, for example, commit crimes against other people, show underactivity in the empathy circuit.
So those are people sort of with permanently damaged empathy, right? I mean, or something. They've got some basic functional deficit. Do you think, I don't know if you can answer this question. Is most of the evil in the world, so your book, again, the title is The Science of Evil. Is most of the evil in the world, do you think, committed by people with standing damage to their empathy circuits? Or do the rest of us schmucks contribute our quotient too?
Well, I make this move in the book right at the beginning. To say that I want to switch from using the term evil to using the term empathy erosion. And we're all capable of losing our empathy, even if it's just by a few points. And we talked earlier about the temporary fluctuations. If you're stressed, if you're tired, your empathy is going to be at a lower level. And, you can have blind spots in your empathy, even though you're not a psychopath. So I don't want to say that all the acts of cruelty in the world are committed by the few percent of people who have a diagnosis.
Right. And then there's other people who lack empathy but don't tend to cruelty. And you've written another book about this, and part of this book is about those folks, people with Asperger's syndrome. Right? Other people's minds and feelings are kind of they're clueless about other people's minds and feelings, as I understand it. Isn't that right?
That's right. So, one of the conclusions, which in some ways is surprising, is that low empathy doesn't necessarily lead to acts of cruelty. So for people with autism or Asperger's syndrome, they do suffer from low empathy. They struggle with empathy, but that tends them to lead them to avoid other people rather than hurt other people. They find other people confusing, and so they withdraw.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the psychology of evil with Simon Baron Cohen, and we've got Nina from Albany on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Nina.
Hi. I was actually just going, you mentioned people with autism and Asperger's, and considering people with Asperger's and autism and people who are evil, maybe it doesn't have to do anything with a lack of empathy, but maybe what society considers to be the norm. So what does society's view on the norm have to do with the psychology of evil?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question, Nina. You think our conceptions of normality somehow drive people to be evil? I'm not quite sure.
Maybe those are the only ways to figure out what is evil. It doesn't have to do with empathy, but maybe just what society thinks is the norm.
Do you get the question, Simon?
Well, one take on Nina's question is that different cultures may set different norms for what is acceptable. So, for example, you might go to one culture where it's completely acceptable to be brutal towards animals and to beat your dog. In the US and here in the UK, that would be a criminal offense. So that, you know, so different cultures set different norms. I don't know whether that's what she's raising.
I see. So, for example, take the genital mutilation of females in certain African cultures. We find that abhorrent, right? And I think, gosh, what an abhorrent practice. I'm taking that out of empathy. But you could find Africans, I suppose, who no diminished empathy, think that's a completely okay practice. So I guess that ask, is there really sort of objective standards of appropriate response and all that? Do you have any thought about that, Simon?
You know, we have to be very careful not to be imposing our own cultural standards, moral standards on other cultures, at least in a preaching or insensitive way. But it is difficult sometimes not to feel that there should be, if you like, a universal set of values. And certainly it is the case that in some cultures, beating children is completely legitimate. It's the way you teach kids is to beat them. And we would find that not just unethical, but illegal in our cultures.
So maybe one way we could look at this is by analogy with the difference between mass and weight. Weight is an ordinary term that was part of folk physics. And then science came along and said, well, what we call weight is really determined by two things, mass and something else, level above sea level. So maybe what you're saying is, look, there's really this, what's really going on in the brain is in these empathy circuits, and it's diminished empathy, normal empathy, extreme empathy. But then there's circumstances within which this takes place, individual circumstances, cultural circumstances. And what we were getting at evil is this more complicated thing. So the diminished brain circuitry or isn't required to explain why somebody in one culture beats children, but it might be required to explain why somebody in another culture beats children when the external circumstances are different. Does that sound reasonable?
That does sound reasonable, but it also helps us to understand why our standards or values may shift even with time, not just across culture. So looking back at the Nazi period of the 1930s, from today's point of view, it seems unthinkable that doctors and scientists could have been involved in conducting experiments towards minority groups that were really cruel. And which resulted in the death of individuals. But at the time, that may have been part of the prevailing ideology that it was okay to do that to certain groups.
Keith from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Keith.
Thank you. And first of all, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Baron Cohen, about your work with autists and Asperger's. And along those lines of empathy, I'm curious as to your thoughts about if empathy is a unipolar or a multipolar concept. Could someone be empathetic in some ways and not empathetic in others, or empathetic towards some types of people and non-empathetic toward others?
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
This is a great question, and we've kind of touched on this in terms of how empathy really operates between two individuals. So you could imagine showing high empathy towards, say, somebody in your family, but low empathy towards your neighbor. And in that respect, you know, you've got the one individual showing a different empathy profile depending on who the target is, who the end receiver is. And equally, we see this a lot when we discuss in-group, out-group relationships. You know, that you may feel you have a stronger empathy or loyalty for people in your own group, and you're more willing to suspend your empathy for the enemy.
So that suggests that these empathy circuits that you find in the brain, and this, we don't have really time to dig into the details of all these different things, but it's fascinating stuff. That suggests that they must be kind of embedded in a whole kind of system in which you tag that person as in or out, and then if they're in, they get treated one way with respect to empathy, and if they're out, they get treated another way. And that's all part of the normal functioning of this complex brain of ours.
Sure. And, you know, we know that that we walk around with a whole bunch of beliefs, including beliefs about our own group and other people's groups. And it's not surprising that our beliefs may influence our emotional stance towards other people.
But that suggests to me, Simon, that, you know, we may not be able to eliminate evil just by making people feel more empathy, because we're never going to eliminate the distinction between in and out. But we'll take that question up in a bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Simon Baron Cohen, author of The Science of Evil, on empathy and the origins of cruelty.
In our final segment, we're going to turn to the issue of social regulation, in particular, social regulation of good and evil. If evil is due to our brain chemistry, then are our ordinary methods of punishment, praise, blame, really to the point? Are they going to turn the wicked good and keep the good on the right path? Or should we be taking advantage of what we know about brain chemistry and treating evil people with drugs or some kind of therapy?
Dealing with the evil among us when Philosophy Talk returns.
I want to be wicked. I want to tell. I wanna be mean and throw my ties. I want to wake up in.
Is it a choice to want to be evil? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Simon Baron Cohen, author of The Science of Evil, on empathy and the origins of cruelty.
Yeah, now, Simon, you've developed this test that gives us a nice bell curve in terms of diminished empathy, regular amounts of empathy, and more empathy than usual. Now, when we have a bell curve like that, then the evaluation is a separate issue. If we have an intelligence bell curve, most people think it's better to be over to the right on the intelligent side than over the left on the less intelligent side. But is it so obvious that it's better to be over to the right on the empathy side to have more empathy? Nietzsche said that do-gooders are the problem. People do a lot of damage to themselves and the world by trying to do too much good. Maybe Ayn Rand is another philosopher who had that point of view. Where on the bell curve do we locate the right amount of empathy for personal happiness and for productive society?
Sure. Well, you might imagine that you can never have enough empathy, so the more the better. But I find it interesting that most of us are just in the average range, and maybe that's actually the optimal level, because it's good to have some empathy. And that's really because it keeps you functioning in a social network without upsetting other people, and able to form relationships with other people. But maybe too much empathy means that you'd never get your own projects completed. Because after all, when you decide to pursue something for yourself, you do need to switch off and just focus on your project.
And not just that, some people don't deserve our empathy. And if you're too empathetic, you might not be able to see beyond who deserves. Hey, Hitler, if I had him in my hands right here, right now, it was just after the war, I would strangle him. Somebody would say, oh, take him to court. I wouldn't take him to court. I would strangle him with my own hands. And I would delight in his pain. And I think I would be doing something morally good. So some people don't deserve our empathy. And I think that must be part of the social glue, too. The threat of losing empathy if you step outside certain bounds.
Yeah, you know, I used to feel exactly the same as you. I used to feel that if I had the opportunity to assassinate Hitler, I'd be the first guy to volunteer to do it. But actually, having written this book and looked at the neuroscience of empathy, one of the conclusions I come to is that when someone has low empathy, it can often be because they've had a very difficult early childhood, or that there are genetic factors that have pushed them towards low empathy, and that whether environmental or biological factors, their empathy circuit is underactive. When you look at it in that way, even if someone is a mass murderer, or if someone is just a difficult neighbor, maybe we should actually have compassion for that person because they have a disability.
So you do think, I wondered if you thought. So instead of punishing wrongdoers, neuroscience, if we learn more about it and how we can actually affect these circuits for the better, maybe we should treat them, to send them to empathy centers to get either empathy training or drugs or something rather than warehousing them in our prisons. Do you believe that?
I do, and it's kind of the logical consequence of what I'm arguing, is that if people have ended up with low empathy because of the way their brain has developed, in a way it's no different to any other neurological disability. And we don't punish people for having a neurological disability. We try and support them. It may be that they have to end up in a secure environment, either for their own safety or for the safety of the general public. But it doesn't mean that we should switch off our compassion for people just because they've done bad things.
Harvey in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Doc, Harvey.
Yes, hello. Yeah, you know, that's what you just talked about. That's like Hillel summarized it in one sentence, you know, if I'm not for myself or from only for myself. But what I called to talk about is, why can't we say that an entire culture is evil? You know, why do we have to say... why do we have to do this cultural relativism? You know, if a culture believes in female genital mutilation or cruelty to children, you know, why can't we say, you know, your culture or this aspect of your culture sucks?
Well, I think we can certainly say that a different culture sucks, and to an extent, our own too. But
Simon, what's your thought on that question?
My thought is that in fact we already do that. There are lobbying groups that campaign to end particular practices, even in other people's cultures. So you know, some political groups are willing to stand up and say we oppose child abuse in other cultures, or we oppose domestic abuse or abuse of women in other cultures. And you know, I think that's probably where things are going to end up, is towards trying to arrive at a universal set of moral values.
But see, there's an empathetic way to trying to do that, and then there's a non-empathetic way. The George Bush New World Order way is, we will impose these values on you with a force of arms. We will come marching in and we will change your society. A more empathetic way is to say, we will try to persuade you and get you to see the force of the better reason, because we respect the role that this plays in your culture, and we're trying to get you to see a better... So you can oppose another culture through argument and persuasion, and that, I think, that bespeaks more respect and more empathy. What do you think about that, Simon?
Absolutely. You know, in my book, I suggest that actually military methods or even legal methods for trying to arrive at resolving a conflict are often not very effective, and that ultimately... empathy has a more effective role to play in conflict resolution, or in trying to reach a kind of middle ground when there is a dispute or a conflict between two ways of doing things.
But I want to take you back to the implication of this, because as some philosophers and theologians will find it kind of disturbing, is it some people believe, you know, there's a difference between a disability, right, say a cognitive psycho disability, and, you know, true evil. True evil is when of a settled, informed, with settled informed knowledge and a free will, you do the wrong thing, right? You choose to do the wrong thing, and you're not really morally responsible unless you have that freedom of choice. You seem to be tending toward a view that that's all just an illusion. right? That it's all really just the brain chemistry. It's hard. It's all just disability. Evil is fundamentally some kind of disability and should be treated as we treat other disabilities. Am I getting you right, or am I reading too much into your view?
No, I think that's pretty close to what I'm arguing. And in fact, it's already happening. So in my country, there's a hospital called Broadmoor. Most people think it's a prison, but actually it's part of our National Health Service. And it's where we lock up psychopaths, but we don't lock them up and throw away the key. There's actually a whole therapeutic program going on. And I'm sure the same is happening in the US too. I'm less familiar with different practices there.
Well, we're a very vengeful people, Simon. So they wouldn't make that public if it were so.
Well, you know, the idea is that people make mistakes, and it doesn't mean that we should condemn them forever. And there are different therapeutic programs that could help somebody come to understand their mistakes.
Well, let me take
one such program is where you bring the perpetrator into contact with their victim, to help them develop some empathy for who they've hurt.
Let me take you back to Hannah Arendt. You talk about the banality of evil briefly in your book, but I didn't quite get what you wanted to say about that, because she thinks that one of the great lessons of the 20th century was when you bureaucratize evil and make it and compartmentalize it, that even perfectly ordinary people can take part without any broken brain chemistry in unspeakable evil and perpetrate unspeakable cruelty. And there's this book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, which talk about what it took from ordinary Germans in order for the Nazi machinery to work. And so I don't know, those people don't need therapy. Their brains aren't broken, right? They just willingly participate in this massive machinery of evil. So what do you say about those people?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're absolutely right that not all acts of cruelty warrant some kind of clinical intervention, but sometimes they warrant more education. And, you know, one thing we do in schools these days is we teach kids about the Holocaust. We teach kids about the Rwanda massacres, because we want to ensure that when the next generations grow up, they do understand the mistakes that previous generations have made. So education is another way in. It's not just about psychotherapy, for example.
Still, when you have someone like Hitler or Pol Pot or some of the mass murderers that, you know, killed lots of innocent children and then ate them and so forth, it seems to me you have a certain dilemma. Namely, if you got them to the point where they empathized with their victims and understood what they had done, they wouldn't be able to live with themselves. Maybe a working definition of evil as opposed to just really bad is when somebody does something that's so bad that no sane person could live with themselves if they had done that.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're raising something very real. So if you spoke to psychiatrists working in secure environments, whether it's prisons or hospitals, with people who've committed murder, for example, you know, many of the perpetrators are very depressed, find it difficult to live with what they've done. So at the point of their act, their empathy went down, but it wasn't down permanently. And a few days later, a few hours later, the horror hits them of what they did and how can they live with themselves. Now, you know, that's no different to, in my mind, to someone who, for example, has diabetes, and their sugar levels went too high, and so they had a diabetic attack, if you like. You know, it's your neurochemistry changing how you behave or how you function.
I get that, but I think you're being too quick here. I mean, I really do, because there's this okay, so you said most of us cluster in the middle range and that maybe that's optimal, right?
Yeah.
It's obvious, and it seems clear to me that, okay, there's some kind of complicated regulation of empathy going on in our whole system. Some people, their empathy regulation mechanisms are way haywire, and some, they aren't. And one of the functions of this empathy mechanism, I think, is to bind you to the in-group and distance you from the outgroup so that you regulate your empathy depending upon whether people are in or out. So the social regulation of empathy sounds like a complicated thing, and unless we all regarded ourselves as all in, one big group, then we're never going to have this kind of universal fellow feeling that Hume dreamed of, but it's merely a dream if you look at the, you know, so I don't think it's all therapeutic, I don't think it's all clinical, I don't think it's all wrong, I think it's really complicated.
It is complicated, but we shouldn't shy away from complexity. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Europe, and you know, a generation ago, Europe was full of divisions, including between Germany and all of its neighbors. Today, we're part of a so-called European community, and so we actually identify ourselves as Europeans, and so the in-group has become much broader, and you can extend that even more widely, so that we talk about the global village of the whole planet these days.
Simon, on that very hopeful and inspiring note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a very cool conversation.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our guest has been Simon Baron-Cohen. He's a professor of developmental psychology at Cambridge University. He's author of The Science of Evil, on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty. So, John, what are you thinking today? You're feeling in a very empathetic mood?
Oh, well, we ended on a hopeful note, and just before that, a not very hopeful note from you, that evil's very complicated. On the other hand, this work that's going on is really interesting, and when you read Simon Baron-Cohen's book, you're aware that he's also done lots of work on autism, which is an extremely interesting topic that we're going to have to visit someday.
Yeah, he talks about that in this book, because autistics suffer from a lack of empathy, but he calls that positive, zero positive rather than zero negative, and it's a complicated thing. And you're right, I think we should do a show about that itself. This conversation continues, however, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also find out a lot more by our buzzing, booming, very, very active Facebook page.
You know, you can also get a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. You sign up for that at our website. That's philosophytalk.org. Now, guess what? For the final word, we get as evil as a man can get, with Ian Scholes, the devil's own 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we have many names for evil people, most of which can't be uttered in polite society, if we can even find a polite society in which to utter. And we have great subtleties of definitions of evil behavior, which can range from murder to cutting me off in traffic. Belligerent ignorance, arrogant entitlement, backstabbing, power grabbing, all fall within the pantheon of evil. But are there people who actually think of themselves as evil? Well, there are Satanists, but the Satanist motto is, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Sounds a lot like libertarianism, doesn't it? Well, back in the day, my comedy group used to open for a San Francisco rock and roll band. During their set, I used to hang out in the back of the room with the band's manager. He'd nurse a beer and make wisecracks. He was a funny, cheerful guy. Very straight-looking, strangely, considering he was the manager of a rock band. He looked like he could have been a clerk in the Macy's men's department. Call him Bob. It happened that our comedy group traveled down to Los Angeles, which we did from time to time in the vain hope of something. We had a day off, so Leon, one of my comedy partners and I, decided to go to Disneyland. While there, we were surprised to run into Bob. He had come to Disneyland by himself, he told us. That was strange in itself. Then he told us he had dropped acid and was going on the Small World ride for the seventh time. He said it was like having bees in your head. He invited us to join him. We declined and took our leave. After much discussion, Leon and I decided that Bob's behavior was odd. Assuming you could accomplish it, why would you even want to have bees in your head? Well, the rock band broke up, our comedy group sort of fell apart, and a few years later, at a party, I ran into one of the former band members who asked me if I'd heard about Bob. Well, no, I hadn't. It seemed that he'd been worried about his girlfriend and was calling her friends, saying he hadn't seen her in a few days. Had they seen her? He was starting to get worried about her. Well, it turned out that even as he was making these calls, his girlfriend was in his apartment, gagged and tied to his bed. He kept her prisoner for a week. Luckily for her, she managed to loosen her bonds when he was out, escape, and called the police. Bob was arrested and is still in prison, last I heard. Now, I can imagine any number of horrible things that might have been done to her while in Bob's clutches, but I still can't imagine Bob doing them. I still keep seeing the genial guy nursing a Bud Light, or the grinning guy with dilated pupils standing among the children at Disneyland. Hard to believe that inside that smiling head, there must have been a constant presence, an angry swarm of churning bees. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a Nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our director of research is Ben Hirsch. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.